someone else's journey is our lesson.
We used to say, the difficult we do immediately, the impossible just takes a little more time.
Someone else's lesson is our gift.
I believe part of our responsibility is really to equip and inspire our students to ask those difficult questions.
Be encouraged by the stories that lift us all.
I came to Howard because I wanted to be the President of the United States.
Somebody saw something in me, and it's my duty to be that person for somebody else.
Now, join Dr. Wayne Frederick, President of Howard University, and his guest on The Journey.
She's working to redefine education by opening up prison cells and literally moving herself and her students into them. As a Howard University Assistant Professor of Criminology, my guest today has used radical teaching methods to empower students to think beyond their circumstances and to consider what it means to be free. Hello, I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick, and my guest on The Journey is Dr. Bahia Mohammed. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Mohammed, you have an unusual approach to the curriculum. The students call it the Dr. Mohammed experience. Tell us a little bit about what that means.
The Dr. Mohammed experience is an out-of-body experience. And so one of the things that I try to do with students is to allow them to understand the literature and the readings and the history behind mass incarceration, but also allow them the opportunity to step into it. And when I say step into it, allow the readings to come to life. Not necessarily in a television type of way, but in a more realistic way. And I do that by taking them to the prisons.
So what started your interest in this area? What really was the thing that made you realize that unless someone had that experience, they really could not fully embody what it meant to be incarcerated?
In 2007, as a doctoral candidate at Rutgers University, I was trained in the Inside Out pedagogy, which happened at Temple University in conjunction with Greaterford Prison. And so for the first time, for a full week, I went in and out of the prison with this particular workshop that was training me in this model. And I worked with juvenile lifers, and it changed me. We took a tour of the facility, so I got to see the yard up close and personal. We actually walked out and went there. I got to see a lot of the cells. I got to see things that I read about in the books, and it became reality for me to see all of the African-American men who were incarcerated in the cages was unreal to me. I had read about it, but to see it so close, it just brought it to life. And from that particular training over the week, I remember going outside after the training was done and recognizing the sun in the air and noticing that there's no windows there. It was just so much that came to life for me that I realized that every class I teach from then on would be structured behind a tour to a facility or to possibly teach the class at the prison.
So I have an interesting perspective about this. My stepfather was a prison officer, and I actually daily in high school would be dropped off at the prison, which was close to my school, which happened to be on Frederick Street. And after school, I would go there to meet him to leave. So the gate opening, because of the size of the gate, the key going into it, the gate closing behind us, all of those things, I remember thinking to myself, just that part of the experience always made me feel that this was not an experience I wanted to have, you know, daily or to have for 24 hours a day. I'm wondering if your students leave with that type of a thought process once they leave, as you had during that time.
It's interesting. The class is so dynamic, and there are so many pieces that are embedded in the curriculum. For example, I teach the class in the middle of the prison. So it's not in the chapel where most of the sessions are. The students actually navigate from the correctional officers in the beginning through clearance into the actual prison where individuals are living and on the phone and eating and watching TV, and they're in the midst of everything. And so I've been finding over the couple of years that there's a delayed reaction So a year later, I get students who are living in Cali in their graduate programs, and they're apologetic, and they're just like, Doc, I didn't get it. I didn't, you know, I'm so sorry. Like, it makes sense to me now. But then you also have some students that know themselves very well, are really in tune with where they want to go, and are living in the present. And those students are some that say, that just shook me up. You know, I felt like walking past that cell, I remember police brutality, or I remember things that happened, Mike Brown, or I think about Sandra Bland. And so it's interesting the things that students say and bring in, and I'm always learning, and I'm really surprised by the things that come out. And then I have some students who, you know, pull me to the side afterwards and say, my dad was incarcerated my entire life, and I've just been living this lie to myself because it just makes it a lot easier for me to go on. This has allowed me to see where he calls. They're just like, these seats are horrible. I mean, he would call back to back to back to back. And so it's really interesting how on different levels it plays different roles depending on what the student brings to the experience, but also how much they engage in the readings and in how it connects to their lives.
You're listening to The Journey. My guest today is Dr. Bahia Mohammed, Assistant Professor of Criminology. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Just to pivot a little bit, when you think of the problem of mass incarceration, give us a definition of what that problem is. Are the numbers what we hear? Are there still myths about the numbers of African-American males who are incarcerated? What really is the size or the magnitude of the problem today?
It's humongous. It's humongous. It makes absolutely no sense at all. The numbers are really large, but they're going down. And they've been going down for some time. It would be nice to start to see a lot more of that in the media and in the literature that's published. Right now, it seems that we're facing a really negative and dire state. In terms of the research, it seems individuals are more interested in the negative outcomes. So we're not showing that right now there are more African-American males on college campuses than incarcerated in certain states. There are a lot of things that are being left out. You also have an empire, so to speak, of individuals and experts who are writing in this area and kind of the go-to individuals. And a lot of the data is outdated data. A lot of the tracking mechanisms that we use to identify the population don't necessarily match the African-American community or their particular experience. And so I think we have a lot more to learn. For example, my study that I'm doing now is looking at success and resiliency among children of incarcerated parents, because a large number of my students talked about having a sister that was incarcerated, a brother, or even a mother, or even being born in prison. And these were students who had a 4.0 in all of my classes, and the classes are pretty difficult. And so I started looking into the data to see, you know, what are we doing wrong? And we're going more on that negative side, where now with children of incarcerated parents, there's a 5-year less likelihood of life for them. And so we've gone as far as death, but we're not talking about the JDs and the PhDs that were born in prison, or the Howard University student who is striving at the same time that they're struggling and taking these criminal justice classes to make sense of it, but still battling with the incarceration. There are a lot of success stories and stories that don't make sense. You would tell an individual these stories, and it's kind of just like there's so many questions that you would rather not talk about it because it doesn't necessarily connect to the data.
All right. Now, when you talk about the prison industry, which is something that I don't think most of our viewers understand, that there is a major industry out there surrounding building prisons and running them that I never realized existed. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. Tell us a little bit about that aspect of it and how much that probably is influencing some aspect of the mass incarceration.
Of course. It's like stocks and bonds. The African-American body, especially the male body, the female body a lot more, but it hasn't overshadowed the total population of black men. it's worth money. You have the school to prison pipeline where it's so lucrative to get a young individual into the prison system early. Not a lot of programming that's offered, especially on the state level and the federal system. They're doing a really good job with innovative programming and being creative and bringing classes in like the Inside Out class and the alternative spring break experience. But in the D.C. jail, you don't have all of those classes. When I go in, I'm bringing 15 students, and I can only select 15 incarcerated individuals. That's a small number compared to the larger numbers. And so it seems that it's about money. It costs a lot more to incarcerate an individual than it does to get a Harvard degree. And a lot of people are not aware of that. They have a really good article that came out talking about million-dollar blocks. And when you walk down the block, you see raggedy buildings, you see broken windows, and you're just like, are you kidding me? But that's the price of the bodies of individuals that have been maneuvered out of their communities and into the prison system. And as you go back, it's worth more and more and more.
How do you break that cycle from using your academic approach, obviously, in teaching, and then bringing it to, I would say, individuals all the way to myself? As a surgeon, I practice at DC General Hospital. We took care of the DC inmates. A lot of them, I would say, I formed, you know, longer term relationships. I've seen some of them outside. People often ask me, who are these folks stopping you to talk to you? Because they don't know how much time I've spent, you know, kind of in and around the D.C. prison system as a result of my work as a surgeon. But how do you move that academic thrust that you have into some kind of policy and action, as well as advocacy, in all of us who are affected by this?
You go to the prison. You go. You also start talking about it. It's amazing to me, over the years, how many interviews that I've done, and I walk into these homes, interview these children in their bedrooms, interview the grandmothers at the table. They are experiencing incarceration 20 years. It's the first time that they've ever talked about it. They don't even understand their narrative. But we call it a rites of passage, and it's not true. If you know about incarceration and you know about rites of passages in Africa and Caribbean communities and Asia, no matter what, you prepare for that. You talk about that. It's something that you are raised and brought up in your womb to be prepared for. It's a great time. It's a celebration. Individuals aren't talking about incarceration within their households. We don't know how to talk about it, and therefore we're passing it down generation to generation. I think that we have to start. It's our time now. The HBCU, the African American community, the Black family, it's time for us to step up and start dealing with the ills that are in our own families and in our communities. And I think the HBCU and the academic community is in a great position in order to guide that, to be able to share the literature, to be able to interview individuals and bring them in and collaborate, community, students, the institution, and turn that around.
So speaking of the family, tell me where you started your journey.
I started my journey in Far Rockaway, Queens. I lived right next to the beach. My mother's family is part of the Sydney Poitiers family, and so they're from the Bahamas. And so we always lived next to the beach, a 23-family kind of mansion house. We had two yachts. We had stretch limousine. I'm one of nine children by my mother. My father has a total of 20 children, and that's from three wives. And so we were really raised together as a family. Everything was about family. I mean, there weren't friends. There weren't, you know, things that we go out to engage in the community. We were in the backyard. We were playing on the steps. We had to be creative. We had to be with each other. We had to build trust. We had to respect. We had to listen. We had to share. And I was homeschooled. My oldest brother and sister were homeschooled up until the ninth grade. And then I have some younger siblings who have been homeschooled all the way through to college. And so it's interesting how we were free minds. I was able to be free, and I went to work with my mother and father every single day. They owned teddy bear factories and stores and businesses. We had Muhammad's Plaza, so there was a fish market there. There was a laundry zone. There was a vegetarian restaurant. And so when individuals were going to school and learning, it was hands-on for me. And so they talk about Montessori now, but that's kind of the learning, that real life learning. And it, I see it embed itself in a lot of my teaching style and the things that I do in the classroom.
Thanks for being here. My guest today has been Dr. Bahia Muhammad, Assistant Professor of Criminology here at Howard University. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Please join me next time on The Journey.
You've been listening to The Journey with Dr. Wayne Frederick on the Howard University Radio Network.